So this is our last week in the book of Revelation, talking about the end times, and then next week is our last week in the series on churchology. And so our last week in Revelation slash the end times, it's only appropriate that we talk about how we are supposed to live until Christ comes. And so I want to start off reading Revelation 21, verse 1. It says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband." So we see the book of Revelation ends with this New Jerusalem descending from heaven. And a lot of the symbolism that you're probably curious about when you read the book of Revelation, a lot of it has to do with this New Jerusalem versus Babylon. Especially from chapter 17 onward, you see this comparison and contrast of this new beautiful city of Jerusalem and then the city of Babylon. And ultimately what they're symbolizing is New Jerusalem is God's kingdom. It is all things good. And then Babylon is the kingdom of this world or the kingdom of evil and all things bad. And so before this New Jerusalem comes, we have to accept the fact that we are currently living in Babylon right now. And we have to learn what it means to live in Babylon. And I think you're like, surely we don't live in Babylon. Let me prove it to you a little bit. I think if you think about the Christians in Africa who are currently being martyred, that's clearly persecution and life in Babylon. There's Christians in the Middle East being persecuted and murdered. That's evidence of being in Babylon. There's Christians in China being persecuted and murdered. That's evidence of Babylon. And I think that sometimes that's like, well, that's far away though, okay? So let's bring it a little bit closer to home. I actually shared this story maybe a couple years ago because this happened a couple years ago, but there was a gentleman in the UK, he was a pastor, and he was praying outside of an abortion clinic. And you can look up, I don't think it's police body cam footage, but you can see he was recording himself when this happened. And the police officer comes up to him and he's like, "Hey, what are you doing?" And he goes, "Well, I'm just standing here." And they go, no, we had reports that you're standing here praying. And he's like, "Well, I'm not praying out loud, I'm just praying in my head." And he goes, "You're not allowed to do that. That's public, this is private property, you're not allowed to be here and you're not allowed to do that." And so I think that they ended up arresting him because he refused to leave. And you're like, "Well, that's still the UK, that's far away." Okay, well, let's talk about Canada. That's a little closer, right? That's our hat, and that's pretty close. And so in the province of Quebec, Canada, there is a new law slash like initiative called Secularism 2.0. Literally, Secularism 2.0. And Jean-Francois Roberge is kind of like the guy who's pushing this along. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to strip any sort of religious or spiritual iconography or behaviors away from public life. And one of the examples, if you just need something tangible, is like they're saying that if you work in a daycare center and you're wearing a cross around your neck, you're not allowed to do that anymore. You're not allowed to wear that cross on your neck. And again, so that you don't think that this is just me trying to make big out of something, let me just quote him so that you know exactly what his intentions are. Jean-Francois Robert says, "It's shocking to see people blocking traffic, taking possession of public spaces without a permit, without warning, and then turning our streets, our parks, our public squares into places of worship. God forbid. God forbid." And I think it's easy to feel insulated in that because we live in the warm arms of Texas and Bible Belt culture. It feels like that's far off. That's never going to happen here. It's going to happen here. It's happening here now. It's going to happen here. And in order for us to understand how to live in the midst of Babylon, I think it's only appropriate that today we're going to look at the book of Daniel. And you're like, "Mitch, I thought we were talking about Revelation." No other book in the Bible. Remember, Revelation is not this book at the end of your Bible that's kind of off by itself. It is a continuation of God's plan. And arguably, no other book in the Bible is more closely related to Revelation than the book of Daniel. Many of the prophecies, many of the symbols and imagery that we see in Revelation comes from the book of Daniel. And where we live in a metaphorical Babylon, Daniel actually lived in Babylon, and he displays to us how we are supposed to live while in exile. It's very much how Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden, and now we live in Babylon until the return of our king. Daniel also was kicked out of Jerusalem and lived in exile until he was able to return. And so in the book of Daniel, God teaches people how to remain faithful while living in Babylon. So first we're going to look at Daniel 6, verse 10. This is the famous story of Daniel in the lion's den. Many of us know this story, but what was happening is that when Daniel and his buddies were exiled, very similar to the story of Joseph, he began doing all the things really well. Just like Joseph was elevated to second in command under Pharaoh, Daniel is doing all of these wonderful things, and he's been elevated up into this top echelon of like three guys who were right under the king, King Darius. And King Darius is planning on making Daniel second in command over Babylon. And the other two guys with Daniel, who are Babylonians, don't like that. And so they're like, how do we get rid of this guy? We don't want this foreigner over here ruling over our country. We don't want this foreigner having rule and authority over us. What should we do? And so they go, we have an idea. We're going to make this decree that says for 30 days, we are only going to pray to our King Darius. And if we pray to anyone else, those people should be thrown into the lion's den. So they bring this decree to King Darius, king of Babylon. And King Darius actually loves Daniel. He cares for Daniel. Daniel's been a good worker. He's proven himself. But they trick him into signing this thing because Darius isn't thinking about Daniel's faith. What he's thinking about is, oh, yeah, you're going to sign a decree that's going to make people worship me for 30 days? Sounds pretty good to me. That's what pride will do to you. So King Darius signs this decree. And it says in Daniel 6, verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he sent to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open towards Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before God, and this is the most crucial part, as he had done previously. You cannot wait until opposition presents itself to decide that God is suddenly important. You cannot wait until the headlines become Huntsville, Texas, rather than Quebec, Canada, to decide all of a sudden my relationship with God takes priority. The reason that Daniel was able to stand against the opposition that he did is because he already knew who he was in Christ, he already knew what was true, and he already knew what he wouldn't bow to. Daniel had already decided in his heart where he was going to stand when opposition came knocking at the door. And so, spoiler alert, if you haven't read Daniel, he gets thrown into the lion's den, and King Darius even says to him, may your God save you. Even King Darius is hoping that Daniel will live through this situation. And then King Darius, that night while Daniel's in the lion's den, King Darius goes and fasts. He refuses to eat because he's so concerned for his friend Daniel. And he wakes up in the morning, he rushes to the lion's den. And he says, Daniel, are you alive? And Daniel says, I'm alive. I have been found faultless before my God and before my king. And so King Darius takes him out of the pit, and then he takes the two guys who made this decree and their families and throws them in the lion's den, and the lions eat them immediately. So in case anybody wants to claim, oh, they just weren't hungry. Oh, they were hungry. They were hungry. And then in Daniel 6:26, King Darius says, I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. Do you see that Daniel's faithfulness and his testimony before evil causes a pagan king to proclaim God's greatness? Praise God. And so our question today is not how do we escape Babylon, but how do we remain faithful while we are there? Because the first thing that Babylon's going to try to do is it's going to try to redefine your identity. You know, talking about culture shock, the first time I really remember experiencing culture shock was when I went to India. You know, I took a plane to Frankfurt, Germany, and I took a plane to New Delhi, and it's nighttime, and you're walking through the airport, and the airport in New Delhi is like any other airport you've ever been to. But the second you step out of those doors, life is different, buddy. And I grew up in Georgia. I'm used to humidity. I'm talking about, it was like people were standing there with buckets and they were like, wait till they open the doors, and then bow, and you're just sweating immediately. Sweat it's just loud. The smells are, it's everything from like burning tires to curry to like filth in the river. And please hear me, I don't want to besmirch people of India. I'm just relating to you my experience. Delhi, in reality, is a very dirty city. It is very third world compared to anything that any of us have been to in the US. And so we get in this taxi, and we're taking this taxi from the Delhi airport all the way to this train station. And there are no such thing as traffic laws in India. There's no, never saw a stop sign, never saw a stoplight. I don't know if they were like, hey, how do we save on infrastructure costs? No stop signs. We just don't pay for them. Because there is no stop and go. Like, there is, if you make eye contact with me, you lost. I go now. Like, that is how you drive. We are driving across a bridge, across one of the major rivers in New Delhi. It's huge. And there is a truck, like an open back truck. It has fallen over onto the road, and there are bags of rice spilling everywhere. There are 20 dudes in flip-flops pushing this truck up. There's no tow truck. There's no police officers. There's no traffic cones. People are weaving around them at 80 miles per hour while they're just lifting this truck. It is chaos. It is absolute madness. We get to the train station, and our guide gets out, and he says, do not get separated from the group. And I'm like, you scared me enough. I'm good. I'm like, I'll stay with you. Hold my hand. Let's go. There is a security checkpoint at the front of the train station. There is a metal detector. No one is using the metal detector. I'm sitting there like, oh, got to put my backpack through. Everybody is just pushing through the stall. Like, nobody's using the metal detector. And I'm just like, there's no authority. There's nobody organizing anything. It is pure chaos. Then we're waiting on the train, and I'm like, painfully aware of how Caucasian I am standing in this train station at 11 o'clock at night, because everyone is just looking at me and I'm like, am I in danger? Am I okay? Are they just curious? I don't know. And then we get on the train, and again, our guide is like, do not get off this train without me. I'm like, I'm not getting out of this seat, homie, okay? He's like, and he says, I kid you not, I don't know if he was trying to mess with us or what, but he was like, if you get off this train, we will never see you again. And then goes to his seat and leaves me. He's in another car. And I'm just like, okay. But can I tell, like, nothing was more culture shock than that. Like, it was one of those, like, I'm uncomfortable continuously. It wasn't like, oh, gee, they have Pepsi instead of Coke. No, it was like, what is happening? Life is totally different right now. And I have to think, what I need you to think about that culture shock moment that you've experienced. And that's something like what Daniel's experiencing in the book of Daniel. Because what's going on in Daniel chapter 1 is that the Israelites, at the time, Jerusalem was kind of like a puppet state for Egypt. They had become subservient to Egypt. They had become reliant on Egypt for money, for food, all sorts of things. They had pledged allegiance to Egypt. And Egypt, I'm pointing as if you're looking at a big world map. That's why I'm pointing where I am. Jerusalem here, Egypt here, Babylon here, okay? So Babylon and Egypt are at war with one another. Well, Babylon says, oh, Jerusalem, this nice prosperous city with all these things, let's just go take it over. So Babylon comes to Jerusalem, takes over the city, kidnaps a bunch of people, and brings them back to Babylon. Daniel and his buddies are some of those people. And so that's where we are in Daniel chapter 1. And forgive me, as we read, this is going to sound like somebody's trying to play a game of Scrabble and they're playing to win. Okay, just stick with me on these names, okay? In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, and some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar and to the house of his God and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Basically, he's saying he took a bunch of stuff from the temple and brought it into the temple of his foreign god. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, Google that if you don't know what it is, to bring some people here, the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. So what was very popular in the ancient world, it's actually very popular in modern times, is you would go to a city that you're taking over, and you would take some of the like highest echelon people, the strongest people, the warriors, the smartest people, and you would kidnap them, and you would begin to indoctrinate them into your culture. You would strip them of their name, you would strip them of their language, you would start feeding them your food, you would start teaching them your culture, and that's a twofold thing. It's a very strategic thing to do. One, you have the best of the best and the brightest of the brightest in your city. That keeps the original city from uprising and rebelling, because if they uprise and rebel, you have a bunch of hostages that you can use as leverage. Also, if you have the best of the best and the strongest and the brightest, and they become assimilated into your culture, they influence the previous city to make it easier to assimilate that city as well. It's a very empire-building tactic. It's the same things that we did to the Native Americans when we came here. It's the same thing the Australians did to the Aboriginals. It's the same thing the French did to the Vietnamese. It's just a tactic of empire-building. And it's pretty effective. And so continuing on, verse 5, the king assigned to them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach, we know these. Mishael he called Meshach, and Azariah he called Abednego. I had a friend who used to say catwhack, hatrack, and to bed we go. That was the easiest way to, that's the easy way to remember. Catwhack, hatrack, to bed we go. And so the significance of these names, they all have religious significance in their language. And so like the name Mishael means Azariah, Yahweh is our helper. Mishael, who is what God is? Who is like God? So then they take these Hebrew names and they give them Babylonian names. And so the one they give to Daniel is, O lady, wife of the god Bel. Shadrach is, I am very fearful of God, but that foreign god, Aku. Meshach is, who is like Aku? And then Abednego is servant of the shining one, Nebo. So they give them all of these names for significance. They're stripping them of their identity of Yahweh, and they're giving them their identity of these false gods. Babylon's first move is to strip you of your identity. It's not just names, it's identity. For us, Babylon still asks us to give up our identity. Our identity becomes our success. It's our political alignment. It's our relationships. Anything but Christ. Satan is happy if you make your identity anything other than Christ. And people may try to rename you, but only God has the authority to define who you are. The second thing Babylon will try to do is it will try to reshape your mind. You know, when I went to India, I decided to learn a little bit of the language because I wanted to like be able to communicate. I wanted to learn a little bit of the culture. I learned like you have to eat with your right hand. You don't eat with your left hand because you use that for other things. And then you also aren't supposed to show the bottom of your feet. So like if you're sitting on the ground, you don't sit like this. You sit with your knees up because showing the bottom of your feet is not the same thing as the middle finger, but similar. You know, it's like, hey, it's insulting. Don't show me the bottom of your feet. And so you learn all of these things, not because I'm trying to become Indian. I'm learning all these things because you can't reach a people you refuse to understand. Learning a culture is not adopting their worldview. And so in Daniel 1, 4 through 5, we see they ask for the youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, competent to stand in the king's palace, to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a portion of food, they drank the wine. They were educated for 3 years. And at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Daniel spent 3 years learning Babylonian culture and learning Babylonian literature. Notice he didn't refuse that. He didn't refuse the education, but he did refuse the indoctrination. He learned the Babylonian language, but he did not adapt the Babylonian worldview. He also allowed them to change his name because he already knew what his identity was. He's like, you can call me whatever you want. I know who I am. You can teach me whatever you want. I know what's true. You know, I think about, you know, we meet on a college campus, you know, this is a college town. And I think about all the parents who are sending their children to college. And so many of them are fearful because they're like, oh my gosh, they're gonna learn all these things that are in opposition to Christianity. But here's the thing. Your children hearing another worldview is not what destroys their faith. Entering college without already knowing their belief is what is dangerous. If you wait until they get to college to all of a sudden tell them everything they need to know, that's the danger. Because when there's an empty void, Satan wants to fill it. That's the thing about Daniel. That's why Daniel was able to stand before the king and not be influenced by the language or by the culture or by them changing his name. They're like, hey, your name is now Belteshazzar. And he's like, my name's Daniel, okay? My name is the one who is like Yahweh, okay? I know who I am. Thank you very much. Like, also, you're going to learn all of these things and you're going to participate in this culture. And he's like, I know the earth's not flat. I don't care if you tell me that or not. I know what the earth is actually like. That's just an example, okay? That's not what they're actually teaching him. The purpose is, it's okay to know the culture. We live in a particular culture. You shouldn't just be like, oh, these college kids, all their crazy apps and all their crazy wants and desires, we just ignore them because they're living for the world. How about this? How about we teach them to live for God then? Are you just leaving them to whatever influence is there? Because trust me, they have influence all over this campus that will teach them whatever they're looking for. Satan has so many different schemes that he can put in front of their face. How about we take the time to teach them about God, teach them about the truth? We can engage in the culture, we can know the culture, but we don't let the culture disciple us. We have to make sure that we know what we believe before Babylon tries to tell us what to believe. So now we get to the pinnacle. Daniel 1, 8 through 16. But, we get to the but. Anytime you see a but, you gotta think, uh-oh, something's about to happen. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or the wine that he drank. Daniel reaches a breaking point. He says, you can change my name. I know who I am. You can teach me whatever you want to teach me. I know the truth. And they're saying, okay, now we want you to consume this food. And Daniel says, nope, that's my breaking point. I'm not going to do anything that's going to defile me. I'm not going to do anything that is going to go against my Lord and my God. And because of Daniel's faithfulness, we see that has an influence on the people around him. It says, therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Verse 9, and God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king? The eunuch's like, Daniel, I like you. You're a nice guy. But if I don't feed you this food, and then all of a sudden you're getting skinny while these other dudes are bulking up, they're going to kill me. And Daniel says to him, verse 11, then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, he says, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and your appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you and deal with your servants according to what you see. He's like, give me 10 days. Give us vegetables and water, and then you can see, are we any skinnier? Do we look any different? And then if we are, you can lie, whatever you want to do, whatever you need to do to make yourself safe, but trust the Lord for 10 days. It says, verse 14, so he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who had ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. This is the difficult part. This is the difficult part about living in Babylon, because it's easy to see something like the Canadian guy I quoted earlier and you're like, that's wrong. Like, that's not okay. You know, it's easy to say, I'm not going to shenanigans and confettis on the weekend. Like, it's easy to look at certain things and say, I'm not going there. But Satan is rarely going to tempt you with something that is obviously destructive. Satan wants to tempt you with something that would be immediately satisfying. Can you imagine Daniel and his boys have been dragged all the way from Jerusalem to Babylon? They're starving. And all of a sudden they sit down and there's this big old plate of pork ribs in front of them. There's this wine that has been defiled because it's not kosher. How tempting would that be to be like, oh, I mean, we're not at home. Like, it's just a couple pork ribs. It's no big deal. Satan's not going to tempt you with the things that are obvious. Satan's not going to tempt you with, you need to destroy your marriage. Satan's going to tempt you with that person who's given you a little bit more attention than your spouse has given you. He's not going to tempt you with saying, don't trust God. He's going to tempt you with saying, man, God's taken a long time to fulfill that promise, right? Satan's not going to tempt you in saying, become greedy. He's just going to tempt you in making you believe that you made just a little bit more money than life would be okay. And Satan's not going to say, abandon your faith. He's going to say, compromise just a little bit because, heck, all your friends are. I mean, you're not any different than they are. And Satan's certainly not going to say, worship an idol. He's just going to tempt you to make you believe that success, comfort, approval, or pleasure is more important than obedience to Christ. The most dangerous temptation is the one that seems the most tempting. That's why it's called temptation. We don't need warning signs on obviously dangerous things. That's why we don't have warning signs on our stoves when they're on, like, don't touch that, it's hot. We know, we learn. Where we need warning signs are the spaces that feel sweet enough to be like, well, maybe. That's why with Daniel, the issue was not the food that he was served, it was the allegiance that he was making. It's not the pork ribs and the wine, it's the allegiance. Do I have my allegiance to this new king or do I have my allegiance to God? Daniel was okay with serving in Babylon, but he was not okay with worshiping Babylon. And so the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation is providing us with the same message. There will be trouble, there will be temptation, there will be struggle, there will be trials in your life. But all of that will be redeemed by the Lord. Romans 8, 18 through 21 says, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed to us. I feel like this is one of those verses that somebody comes up to you and they're like, man, I'm having a really hard time. And they're like, yeah, well, you know, your present sufferings are not comparable, you know. So like, stop being a baby. And you're like, thanks, everything has changed now. All of my problems have dissipated. Like, that's not what this is trying to say. This is not denying the existence of struggle. This is providing us with a hope. This is not saying, hey, your struggles are simply going to be stopped or halted, but our future hope is going to be so great that we're going to forget about these troubles. Have you ever been doing something that is just like, you're so frustrated with it, you're tired, and then all of a sudden, I'm trying to think of something. I can't think of anything better than when I was a kid. I remember my dad, he made me go out in the yard and pick up pine cones. I don't know. I felt like it was just a punishment thing. He was like, we need to pick them up because the grass can grow. And I'm like, I feel like I'm in trouble. Like, I don't know. And I'm like, so I can use the lawnmower? He's like, no, by hand. And I'm like, this is definitely a punishment. So I've got like a trash bag and I'm like picking up pine cones. And I'm like, this is the worst. I've got like pine cones in my hand. Didn't give me gloves. You know, I don't know. Again, felt like a punishment. I'm just saying. And so I'm picking up pine cones, throwing them in this bag. And I'm like, this is the worst. My back hurts. And I'm like 16. You know it's bad if you're 16 and your back hurts. You're like, oh my gosh. But then my dad comes out and he's like, hey, when you finish picking up those pine cones, we're going to go to Brewster's, which is like an ice cream place. I don't know if you guys have ever been to one. And I was like, Brewster's? We're going to Brewster's? I loved Brewster's. It was my favorite ice cream place. They had like my favorite flavors and everything. So all of a sudden, I'm like, I don't care about picking up pine cones. We're going to Brewster's after this. Like, that's a very stupid surface level illustration. But do you understand what I'm trying to say is that God is not saying that your sufferings are not real or not valid. What he's saying is that the hope that we have that is coming is going to be so wonderful. And when we experience it, all of these other things are going to be like, what? I don't even remember that. That's not even worth considering because of the glory that I now get to experience with the Lord. And so while we're here, Babylon is going to continuously demand your loyalty, but you have to remember that Jesus is the only one that deserves your worship. Daniel lived in Babylon, but he refused to let Babylon live in him. He's like, I'll be here, but like their boundaries are going to be maintained. We live in Babylon, but we don't let Babylon live in us. And so we're going to wake up every day in Babylon. You go to work in Babylon. Your kids go to school in Babylon. You raise your family in Babylon. We consume Babylon's media. We feel the pressure of Babylon. But you have to know all the while that we belong to another city. Philippians 3:20 says our citizenship is in heaven. And what we are is we are like a colony of the New Jerusalem here on earth right now. And we are called to be liaisons. We are called to be ministers of that city in Babylon. We're not just building up walls and trying to keep everybody else out. No, no, no. We're trying to bring more and more people in. We want more and more people to enter into the city of Jerusalem. We don't want to leave them in Babylon. We want to show them that Babylon is a lie, is going to be destroyed. We'll leave them wanting, but the new Jerusalem is what's going to bring them life and hope. You know, when I was in Australia, we were doing street evangelism, and me and my mentor, Ben, were walking around the city just kind of randomly talking to people about Jesus, and we went down this side street, And as we're walking down the side street, we realized, like, there's not a lot of people here. We need to cut back over to the main street. And so we cut through this alleyway. And when we do, there's a man sitting on a flower box smoking a cigarette. And he's Indian, I can tell. And he's also wearing a necklace around his neck. And like from a distance, I can tell it's like an idol of some sort. It looks super familiar to me. And as we get closer, I realize it's an idol of Shiva. It's one of the Hindu gods hanging around his neck. And he's sitting there smoking a cigarette. He seems kind of down. He's clearly like on a break from work. I think he was a chef. And we start talking to him. And I'm like, hey, what is that around your neck? And he's like, oh, this is a god. It's Shiva. I pray to it every once in a while. I was like, okay. Do you pray to any other gods? He's like, oh yeah, I've got like thousands of gods. I was like, oh, okay. I was like, do you have any like idols in your house? Like, he's like, yeah, I've got little wooden statues that I have that I pray to sometimes. I was like, do you know who Jesus is? And he's like, yeah, he's like another one of those thousands of gods that I can pray to. And I was like, okay. I was like, brother, let me tell you something. What are those idols made out of? And he's like, well, I think they're wood. And I'm like, I have news for you. That's all they'll ever be. They're just wood. That thing around your neck, it's just gold. One day it's going to be melted. That wood is going to be burnt up. Jesus is the only thing that will be remaining, and it's the only one of these gods that you can actually have a relationship with. All of these other things are false idols that promise you so much and never give you anything, that are asking you to come to their altar, to give you these things, to sacrifice all these things, and then just maybe, I'll give you something. Jesus gave himself for us so that we can have everything. And I was like, can I pray for you? And he was like, yeah, okay. And so I just prayed over him, and we prayed for him to receive Jesus, to see Jesus as the true God, and to recognize all these other things as false. And I prayed that all his idols would fall apart and break and burn or something like that. And I was just like, I'm just saying, so I hope they get destroyed and show that, Lord, do your work and show them that you're real. And so... And here's the thing, I'm like, I want to respect that man's culture, but I could not bow to his idols. And not because I hated him, but because I love Jesus. The same way Daniel's not just rejecting Babylon, he's rejecting idolatry. And you know, one of my greatest joys of going to India was not seeing the temples and the mountains and tasting the food. One of my greatest joys of being in India is that it provided me with an opportunity to see someone who once prayed to idols begin praying to Christ. To show someone who's been living in Babylon what it's like to live in Jerusalem. To show somebody who's living in this state of chaos and anger and fear to start living in joy and hope and freedom. That is the greatest joy. You know, at the beginning of the sermon, I told you guys about this Canadian politician and his terrible plans and political ideas. Please hear my heart. I am not calling you to be political activists who are throwing bricks through politicians' windows. You can't blame that on me. That's not me. I'm not telling you to spend your life protesting every headline you see or arguing with every person you come across with a different opinion. I'm calling you to know Christ so intimately and so well that when you hear Babylon speak, you know. That's what I'm calling you to. Daniel did not spend his days in Babylon like protesting and picketing and yelling at the king. Daniel spent every day in Babylon walking with God. And because he knew God so well, he immediately recognized when Babylon crossed the line. And that's why we remain faithful in Babylon. Not because we're trying to win arguments or because we are still trying to fight off the bad guys, but because there are people in Babylon who still need to be introduced to the real king. And we need to show them the real king, the true kingdom. And so until Jesus returns, we have to know who we are, know what you believe, know who you worship, and don't become Babylon, but instead be a glimpse of the new Jerusalem. Amen.